Welcome to the September 4th, 2008 meeting of the Harbor Advisory Board. Let the record show that we have all members present with the exception of Ed Ewing and Michelle Leary. And as far as the staff presence is concerned, we have absent Rick Alkert, the Harbor Director. Let me ask members of the board if there's any changes or alterations of the minutes of the last meeting. Hearing that there are no corrections, do I have a motion to accept the minutes as presented?
I'll make a motion to accept the minutes as presented.
Is there a second?
Second.
Okay, motion made by Bill and seconded by Lynn to accept the minutes as presented. All those in favor?
Aye.
Opposed? Minutes are approved. Before we go to oral communications and public comment,
our wildlife group deals with lots and lots and lots of seabirds, and so we do have, you know, like we're in like careers here, so to speak. Specifically, what I wanted to tell you about today, and I'm not sure if you're aware, but we've received in the last 2 months about 140, the numbers are still rising, brown pelicans that have been come into our center for care, and they have been anywhere from, we're dealing problems with starvation and broken wings, but primarily what we're concerned about is the increased number of fishing line and fishing hook injuries. I brought just a few bags of the recent entanglements that we've taken off of these birds. Excuse me, I have a little frog in my throat, but we've just kind of wanted to open a dialogue with you and see if there's something we could do together to inform the public a little bit more about these problems. Generally what happens at this time of year, the brown pelicans have left the islands, the Channel Islands, and the Gulf of Mexico, the islands off the Gulf of Mexico, and this is prime hunting ground for them for the last who knows how many years. But generally, the juvenile pelicans are just learning how to hunt and forage, and sometimes they're not so successful, especially when you have a year like this one where there are lots. So on one hand, it's really good that there were lots born this year, but on the other hand, that just means a lot more interactions with, you know, in this case, fishing line and fishing hook with people fishing off the piers. Now, I don't fish, so I can't say that I have working knowledge of how it works out there, but I do know, just from our standpoint, we've received lots and lots of pelicans with the line just wrapped really tightly around, let's say, the hock, the foot, the leg, cutting off circulation and losing the leg and oftentimes losing the life. Now, you know, there's a certain amount of, you know, attrition rate in juvenile pelicans, and so we understand that. But just thought that maybe there could be a list. Avoid casting when seabirds are present. If you should hook a bird, never cut the line. Get help to safely remove the bird from the water with a net. You can get help from any city employee or native animal rescue worker. You know, do not chase the bird, place the bird in a kennel. Just some basic signage to help people. I think that a lot of times people get out there and don't know, maybe they cut the line if the bird gets hooked or if the fishing gear gets caught up in rocks maybe. And then fishing line is floating around also. So we'd like to just see a little bit more responsibility getting rid of those fishing lines and hooks. Oftentimes these birds will come in with, I've had 6 hooks I've taken out of one bird. They're everywhere and lying wrapped around. We can help these birds and get them back. We've had numerous that we've re-released and so I just really think that we need to just be aware that, I remember 5 years or so ago when I read in the paper that over 40% of our visitors to the county come to observe wildlife. I mean, it's a big wildlife county. And we just want to be responsible, and have dialogue and learn. I mean, if you don't know what to do, we'll help you. We're right here in Morro Bay. I don't know if you all know that, but we're doing some great work. We've worked with about 1,400 wildlife animals total just so far this year. And so we're real active in the county. We have lots of good volunteers, though we, could always use more help. And the other thing is these birds are costing us like approximately to rehab one pelican, $200 a month. And that's the minimum. That's just for food, and that doesn't count any extensive medical care. So we're paying that, and we're also feeding these pelicans daily. And the average time they're with us is about a month. And so that's about at the minimum of $200 a month per bird. So we've been really, we would like to see, for many multiple reasons, less birds come in. That's it. And if you have any other questions, I'd be really happy to talk with anybody about anything. Maybe getting some signage. I understand that you do have signage out there, but maybe that's a really, really conservative number. Things are going to happen. Accidents are going to happen. We don't expect that it's not. But we just want you all to be informed what we're doing, and maybe we can see some, a little bit of upped signage out there. And appreciate your time.
Lynn, do you have a comment or question?
Yeah, my question is this signage that you would like to have. The first point that you made was don't cast when there are birds around, except I think they catch a fish, and then the birds come.
Do you fish?
Sorry. No, I don't fish.
Oh, is that what happens?
Well, I see people fishing, and then you see the birds diving where they're fishing.
Yeah.
So I'm kind of speculating that that's what happens. And if that's not what happens, or if we don't know what happens, we need to talk to some fishermen.
Yeah,
you need to get some more data on exactly what does happen so that this signage or so that this education can be a bit more specific than saying...
That's fair. That's definitely fair.
What to do.
Right.
The second point that you read was... don't cut the line. And I can imagine, I have had one experience where there was a pelican and it had a line around him and he was fighting it. I cannot imagine somebody trying to do something other than cut the line.
I guess, I was just reading what Santa Cruz did, but to add to yours, and I really agree with you, it's not we're saying don't cut the line. I think what we really would like to extend that to say is don't cut the line and let the animal go out there, because what does happen is we've been told by several people, this fisherman, it got tangled up, cut the line, and I saw the bird go off.
Right.
Now, I know that. I've had that story told to me several times, so I know that happens. And that's what I think we're worried about. It's like, don't, because that animal is not going to be okay. It's
right.
Not
but if
be okay.
They hang on to the line... and their fishing pole,
okay.
And it's around this bird, and this bird is fighting, are they supposed to reel it in?
No.
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 So, you see, what I'm imagining, it leaves the poor fisherman with no out. There's nothing to do unless somebody shows up very quickly.
Mm-hmm. I have to tell you,
yeah.
I'm hoping that there can be dialogue, and we can figure out how we can do this to make it better, because I imagine that it's just going to be a continuing problem. And so there has to be some kind of
Well, in a way, I think I'm putting the burden back on you, saying you need to do some more research and give something that's a little bit more specific and, at least in my mind, a sort of realistic.
What would you think?
Well, exactly what I just said. I mean, the fisherman, his line gets caught around the bird, or the bird takes his fish and the hook. And what is he supposed to do? He can't cut the line. He can't reel it in.
Well,
he needs to call.
You're right. Or get some, you know, get some help. Say, hey, I caught this bird. You know, somebody can go call the Harbor Patrol. I mean, I don't know too many people that don't have cell phones anymore. I think something could be done relatively quickly. And I'm not saying he has to stay there till 10 o'clock at night and wait till something happens. But generally, we can probably help him out. Something can be done. So, I agree with getting data as far as learning more of the situations that happen out there.
Right.
I'd be happy to. Unfortunately, I spend so much time caring for these animals that I haven't to the time, but we'll definitely put somebody on that and get in some research as to what happens with these fish typically with the fishermen. And that's actually a very good point.
Thank you.
But I really do think that we can meet halfway on that, you know, the fishermen and the you know, the situation.
Jean? He's already had a chance.
Can you tell by looking at the hooks whether they are a live bait hook, like the drift fishermen would be using for
the
sardines?
Would you like to look at some of these hooks?
Sure. Or where it would be like a dead bait hook that a pure fisherman might perhaps use.
As one who's gotten a lot of the phone records, I just wanted to interject. Most of the birds we're getting are not birds that are diving into fishermen's lines. They're birds that are being found on the beach having been tangled in line. We're getting birds that have it wrapped around their legs and wrapped around their wings. The other day I got one in that actually died on the table, wrapped around to the bone on its leg, its wing, and the hook in its tail. So these aren't necessarily birds that are diving down and catching fish and getting hooked. They're not coming in with mouth, and then they're getting caught in the mess that's laying there.
Can we get your name for the record? I'm sorry.
I would like to...
Kathy Duncan. Yeah.
Thank you.
To add a couple of comments, too. First of all, the effort to achieve some public awareness is a good start here, because this is televised to the community. Secondly, as you probably already know, there is a nice article in the local section of the Times, Tribune. Yep, there it is. And that was a good start, too.
Yeah.
I don't know how effective signage would be. I recall with the issue of snowy plovers and the access where I would walk going onto the beach, the entrance path was maybe 8 feet wide, and there's big signs on both of them. You could stand there all day and watch people walk past the sign with their dogs, headed to the beach where the dogs weren't permitted. So I'm not convinced that signage alone is going to do a lot of good. I would think... if you have volunteers for your group, they could go out on weekends, busy weekends in particular, and go to those areas where fishermen congregate along the harbor, on the piers, and on the riprap that's along the embarcadero there, and just provide lessons, for instance, of what to do in the case of a bird is hooked. Thirdly, I am a fisherman, I have had, fortunately, not the experience of catching a pelican, but I have had seals come up and take the fish I'd caught, and of course they break my line easily. But I have had a seagull do the same thing on cast bait before it has a chance to sink, and they're a tough fight too, trying to get those to calm down enough to and I've not had the experience of that either. The seagull let go of it before any further problems. But I can just imagine from a fisherman fishing with light tackle in the harbor here, who does, for whatever reason, hook a pelican, would have an enormously difficult time trying to do as that sign you say was in Santa Barbara suggests.
Santa Cruz, yeah.
Or Santa Cruz. The pelican's not going to be very calm when it feels it's captive.
Right,
and
right.
They can.
Yeah, they do.
They can be pretty.
Animal numbers have doubled this year, and we really don't have that amount of volunteers to be able to go out and do that. But I do think it is a cooperative thing. I really think we can work together on. And I don't know what the best way is, but signage seemed to be something that was used elsewhere, so I thought it was a start to discuss it. I don't, you know, I think we really do need to talk with some other fishermen to see, you know, since we're having a dialogue, what would you, you know, what could you see? I mean, what's a typical situation where we could help or where you could, I guess what I'm just trying to say is, you know, let's just not let these animals go and die.
Sure.
Let's do something because there's lots of people that care and want to help and we're not so far away and we can certainly help if we are just humanitarian about it. We really are, take our higher level of intelligence and use it. And I really think we can come up with something. Mm-hmm. So thank you so much.
Let me just see if you had a further question.
One last question. What is the policy of the Harbor Patrol? Do they get called right now? I mean, do you go out? I mean, what is your policy right now?
We do get calls frequently, and we oftentimes will get people bringing pelicans into our office with hooks and lines, and our patrol officers have gotten pretty adept at freeing them whenever possible. When it's something that looks really critical, we rely on you guys, and you've been great, and we try to work with you on that.
Mm-hmm.
And we do have signage on both the piers, and it was pointed out by somebody that they felt the signage could be in a little bit better places, and we are getting some new signs, so we're trying to make the signs in a little bit better places.
Thank you.
We're also working on getting some Do Not Feed the Wildlife signs mm-hmm. to put out at Target Rock and the ocean side of the rock for people who are feeding the seagulls and the ground squirrels, as that can be hazardous to both people and the animals. So we do try to be very proactive. We also have pamphlets in the office about fishing lines and the injuries that they create with birds and what people can do to avoid that. So we try to be proactive as much as we can.
They have been wonderful. And I have to say that, you know, we get a lot of the birds from you. And so most of your people are pretty available.
Oh, yes.
Around. And so I would imagine, as you always have done, you'd be willing to continue to help.
Of course.
To at least learn, you know, to free them mm-hmm. and then get them to us.
Other than what is on the agenda, can step forward now and introduce yourself. And
Honorable Chair Phillips and friends on the board, my name is Joey Ricano. I'm with the California Ocean Outfall Group, and unfortunately, I have to be somewhere, so I'm going to have to leave. So this will be my only opportunity to speak. I'd like to start by thanking Pacific Wildlife Care for their great selfless work, and I'd like to thank Harbor Department for their cooperation with helping them protect our precious coastal resources. And I'd like to thank this board for giving Danny Nicholson the great length of dialogue that this important issue deserves. Tonight I'm here to bring good news, and the good news is that, as you know, we have a marine protected area in the Morro Bay East Estuary, that is the Morro Bay East Estuary State Marine Reserve. A State Marine Reserve is the highest level of protection that any MPA gets, a marine protected area. There are various levels, various degrees of protection. An SMR, as they are known by for short, is an area where take is prohibited, and that includes a sewage discharge, once through cooling for a power plant, in any type of seawater intake, and any biological disturbance. On September 21st of last year, the State Marine Reserve in Morro Bay East Estuary took effect. Since that time, on January 27th of this year, the California Men's Colony Prison had a mishap where a generator failed. Then a backup generator failed, and what happened was they wound up spilling 20,000 gallons of raw sewage into Chorro Creek. Now, it could have been a lot worse. There were another 200,000 gallons spilled, but they were able to divert it into the old plant, and so a much larger catastrophe was averted, and for that they are to be commended. Some of the things that that would bring to mind is how dangerous it would, who will be taking public comment on this tomorrow. He sent out an email with PDF files that showed that they had been prosecuted for an MPA violation. It's on page 2 of attachment 3. It's section 5A. What's really important is that this set the precedent. This was the precedent for the entire state of California, first time a marine protected area violation had been prosecuted, and it was a precedent for the MLPA, the Marine Life Protection Act itself. So I think that it means that there are teeth in the MLPA. Now, tonight you're going to be discussing the environmental impact report for a marina to be dredged out and for a seawall to be built, etc. There are three monumental barriers to this ill-advised proposal. The first one is that it's a state marine reserve and the precedent has already been set. You would have to prove that take would not occur in the state marine reserve by the activities that would take place in an expanded marina. You know, a lot of these boats mix oil and water and then they dump it in the water, and that's how they operate. It's not like anybody's trying to pollute. Then you have the issue of the seawall. Armoring the coast is against the Coastal Act of California, and I don't believe that would ever fly with the California Coastal Commission or the Sierra Club or me or anyone. And then finally, there's the issue of seeking a waiver or a variance from the Environmental Protection Agency for dumping mud onto a sandy ocean bottom habitat. In Los Angeles, there was, at the Port of LA, they wanted to expand and there was nowhere to expand to. So what happened was they made a deal with Orange County and Huntington Beach, and they dumped soil in the water and they destroyed sandy ocean bottom habitat at the Port of LA and gave themselves more port. In return, mitigation, it was a $79 million fee that they gave to Orange County to open it up, and it was a big success. Jack Fancher from Fish and Wildlife, I was there. Cruz Bustamante was there. It was really something. It was a lot of hubbub about it. But I don't believe that this is financially feasible here, and if you can't just dump the mud on the sandy ocean bottom habitat, you'll have to cart it away in trucks. That makes it, like, I think, $27 million. I mean, I'm probably a little bit wrong about these numbers, but the $27 million, but I think that's what I read about this project. And so that would make it financially not feasible. Yes, sir. Yes, Chair Phillips.
Your comments are related to the public hearing that hasn't started yet, mm-hmm. and the oral communication is to be directed towards issues that are not on the agenda. So if you want to speak to the issue of the environmental, the draft of the environmental impact report, I would rather have you do that in in the
right,
proper
I understand.
Place.
Unfortunately, I have a prior commitment, and I have to be at another meeting. And so what I did was I thought that I would give you guys the heads up on some of the things that you were facing, and I'll move away from that issue now.
Please try to be brief and summarize as much as you can.
Yes, and I will, Chair Phillips. So, therefore, I think what we're looking at here is we're looking at a situation where it's like a mouse eating a book. He's eating a Charles Dickens book, but he's just eating the paper, and he's not realizing what the words say. What we have here is probably the most beautiful place on the California coast, bar none. And what you have here is an area where financially it's depressed, and the whole country is this way right now. You know, the Dow dropped 400 points today. People from other countries, their money's worth a lot more here, so they come here. So they will be willing to come here because they're rich when they come here. So ecotourism is the way to go, and not to destroy the environment here that you have just seen created into a state marine reserve. I don't think Arnold Schwarzenegger is going to go for it, and I know I'm not going for it. And so I don't think that any of the environmental groups are going to go for armoring of the coast, dredging, asking the EPA for another waiver. We just got rid of the waiver here, the 301H waiver. And
is there anyone else in the audience who wants to make public comment on any issue other than what's on the agenda? Okay. Seeing none, then we'll move on to item number 4-1, which is a public hearing on the draft environmental report for the State Park Marina Renovation and Enhancement Project. And for that, we have Ray DeWitt, project manager for Padre and Associates, here to make a presentation.
I'd also like to mention we have Mike Prater, who is our planning manager here, who can maybe give us a little rundown on the overall planning implications. And I'd like to remind anyone who wants to make a comment that we're basically taking comments on the EIR, not necessarily on specific designs. So that's something to keep in mind on the comment period. So if Mike, if you want to give just a brief overview of the planning, and then we can have Ray and Brian do the presentation. Okay.
Good evening, Chair, board members. What you're going to hear tonight is primarily kind of a brief overview of the effort that went into creating the draft environmental impact report. And by all means, if they're simple enough questions and answers, we can probably try to address those and get you something. But primarily, it's to take the comment, write them down, and supplement the final draft of the EIR so that all the final responses will be part of that final document. What we're doing with this particular project from the planning front, this has been a number of years in the working and throughout my department and my office and working with, closely with Padre and Ray and his company. Is to look at it from the planning aspect of what it would take and go through the process. And part of the big part of that is the environmental review process, which is sort of spearheaded the bulk of this of the document that's before you that you've had a chance to hopefully look at. In the end, I think the goal is to have this document evaluated by our city council and have it certified so that it becomes a live, usable document for the future, at least for a potential near future if a project ever does.
I would like to ask you just for sure. A little bit more clarification so that I can understand it better. From the draft stage, after the public comment, there's a final environmental report that will then go to the city council for their approval.
Correct.
And once it's approved there, assuming that it would be approved there, what happens to it then?
Well, at that point, it becomes a certified document. We'll have that go through the formal process to notify that that's been certified. And then at that point, I think we're working back with the Harbor Department to finalize what actual project we want to pursue that has been analyzed as an outcome of this review.
At that certification point are all of the agencies that need to have a say, have they had their say by that point so that we have clearance from?
We're definitely hopeful that they've had an opportunity to comment and have a say at that point. Ultimately, if a project is identified, and if a project particularly is identified that's part of this review, we'll move forward for permits, and that will likely be a permit from the California Coastal Commission. And so they'll, again, probably have an opportunity to speak if they did not choose to speak at this certification phase. They will speak, obviously, at the permit phase.
So once the permits are approved, then funding is sought to accomplish the project.
To accomplish that project, okay. Yeah.
Thank you very much.
Chairman Phillips, members of the board, my name is Ray DeWitt. I'm with Padre Associates, and I'm the project manager for the draft environmental impact report. With me tonight is the assistant project manager, Mr. Brian Dugas. He also is the principal investigator for the terrestrial onshore biological assessment and that particular technical issue. And to reiterate what Mike just mentioned, we're here tonight to give a summary, an overview of the proposed project, and a summary of what we found and how we documented the potential impacts and identified the recommended mitigations for the proposed actions. And the focus here is to take comments on the EIR, and because CEQA requires that we not only document but also respond to each comment, rather than do those orally, we want to make sure we get them down on the record, and they will be responded to in writing. 1949, currently 115 slips, and the basic dimensions and the character of that particular facility are shown in this particular slide. I do want to show that the original dredge depth was to minus 8 feet, mean lower. That MLLW stands for mean lower low water. It is a datum, and that's a datum I'll use all the time when we're talking about water depth. It currently ranges from about minus 6 feet in about 10% of the area towards the eastern end, and averages about 3.5 to 4 feet mean lower low water throughout the majority of the basin. This, hopefully you can see, and there's a larger picture of the proposed marina layout on the floor over here, but this shows the proposed layout with the dredge basin that will include not just the marina itself, but also the entrance channel. This will all be taken to minus 12 feet. Cross-section, hopefully you can see this. I'll just point out, this is cross-section B, which is through this area right through here. The existing restaurant is over here. And as you can see, what we have is we have two vertical steel sheet pile walls. The one on the south marina, on the south shoreline, is a submerged sheet pile wall. It will not extend higher than the zero tide line. That's mean lower low water. The other is a vertical sheet pile wall that will extend to about plus 9 feet. And the depth of the water here is a uniform minus 12 feet. This particular cross section shows an area that is closer down to where the new, where the new restroom facility and shower facility will be, cut through this area. Again, just shows the vertical wall and what the basin will look like. And this area here is a cross-section of the entrance channel. The natural water depth at about this point is minus 12 feet. So the intent here is to have a 50-foot wide entrance channel. It will be a uniform 12 feet that will allow ingress, egress, even on the lowest of tides. Some of the proposed in-water improvements are listed here. The American Disabilities Act requires certain characteristics, certain widths, etc., of marinas, walkways, as well as breakwater that's along the northwest portion of the marina. That will be removed. The steel sheet pile walls that I mentioned, approximately 1,000 feet long on the northern shoreline and about 1,100 feet long along the southern shoreline. And the dredging itself, which will to take it to minus 12 feet, will be approximately 147,000 cubic yards, of which approximately 20,000 cubic yards is expected to be utilized on site for fill, backfill behind the northern seawall or the sheet pile wall, and also for additional bedding material for the new parking lot. So the remainder will be dried on site and trucked to the Windsor mine site in Cambria. Now, there is no offshore disposal proposed for the proposed action. And you can see the size of the new docks and the components of the actual slips themselves on the bottom part. Onshore, we're looking at improving the existing entrance, making that a 30-foot wide entrance, providing signage and lighting. There will be a relatively new emergency exit at the far east end, which will have bollards for control of ingress, egress. It will only be used in emergency. It will be gravel covered. It will not be asphalt. There will be, as I mentioned before, the shower and restroom building. There will be a new stormwater system that will consist or will have or comprise an oil water separator and several drop outlets and one-way flapper valves. These will discharge to the bay into the marina, but they will first have gone through an oil water separator. And the flapper valves on themselves will keep the high tide water from going back into the components themselves. Native and drought-tolerant landscape. And there'll be a new launch ramp, which will be in the area which is immediately to the west of where that wooden wall I mentioned now. And it's a semi-launch ramp, but there'll actually be a concrete launch ramp that will be designed for car top and kayak launches facilities. And then, of course, some onshore amenities such as lighting and benches, etc. Now what I'd like to do is to go through briefly what we found to be the potentially significant impacts from the proposed action. And that includes these listed here. Joey talked about those briefly, but what we have in the marine, of course, we have not only wetlands and mudflats, but you also have your infamous eelgrass. And the estimates are we have done a pre-construction eelgrass survey, and we're looking at about a half an acre of eelgrass that will have to be, that will be affected and will have to be mitigated. And I'd like to have Brian just talk briefly about the onshore terrestrial and habitat components that we've also identified.
Thank you, Ray. Brian Deuce with Padre Associates. Thank you, Chair Phillips and board members. We have two federally listed species on the in and around the marina itself. One is the California sea blight, which is a tidal species, plant species that exists in the salt marsh. It primarily exists along the northern and eastern portion of the marina, and as well as we have the shoulder band dune snail, which you probably know very much about in this area. It has the potential to occur in the Central Coast dune scrub habitat along the eastern side of the marina, as well as along the south side. We've had some early communications with the U.S. Fish and Wildlife Service regarding these species, and incidental take permits won't be required, and we'll have to develop some relocation and pre-activity survey plans to deal with these species during the project. So if you have some more questions about that later, we can address those. Thank you.
Brian? Just continuing on the cultural resources aspects that were identified, the wall that that was built by the WPA back in the 30s has a potential to be damaged. But in addition to that, there's a rather large, well-documented midden that extends basically from White Point all the way down into the marina area. And as I'll talk about in just a minute, we have identified mitigations. But that's a sensitive resource, a cultural resource that does have to be accounted for. Noise, the predominant noise generator that we're going to have is going to be from the driving of the piles. And while the engineers tell us that it's very likely that we'll be able to use a vibratory hammer, there is a possibility we'd have to use a regular impact hammer for some driving some of the latter part of the into the actual bay formation itself. But that's the primary noise aspect. Of course, there will be cranes, and there will be other machinery that will be working in the area. So noise is a component that we'll have to that we have identified and we will have to mitigate. Traffic and circulation, interestingly enough, one of the biggest concerns we had when it was decided that the dredge material would be dried and taken upland to an onshore disposal site was potential for traffic impacts related to that that increase in truck traffic. And to get a hold of it and to read it, because while this is more or less a bullet list, the explanation of what these mitigations actually entail are detailed in that discussion, in the document itself. So if you have any questions on what all these mean, I think it best that you can go ahead and get into the particular technical issue and look for the mitigation measures as well as the impact assessment. But these are the mitigations that we've identified for air quality and the habitats and the biology. They are somewhat standard, but at the same time, they take very much into consideration the particular resources and habitats that are at the particular site, not the least of which is shallow water habitat that Joey mentioned earlier, wetland areas, and sandy beach, as well as our friend the eelgrass. That one? Okay. Cultural resources. I mentioned this before. Our cultural resource specialist has identified a series of pre-construction surveys as well as tagging, marking, and recovery. And this will be detailed in a plan that will be put together prior to any type of excavation. There will also be an on-site monitor whenever there is any ground disturbance activities in the onshore area. Noise. Again, depending on the type of equipment, what we need to do is to be sure that the decibel levels do not exceed the noise ordinance requirements the city and the county have within the sensitive receptor area, which, of course, is the restaurant and the campground and the museum. Those are the three proximal sensitive receptors. But there are methods, once we know exactly what the dB levels are, that we can that can be instituted, that would include barriers, that would include mufflers. There are several different methods by which we'll be able to mitigate those, and those again are identified in the EIR itself. Traffic and circulation. I mentioned again, I mentioned earlier the concern more over the condition of State Park Road as a major ingress egress for the construction as well as the disposal material. And so, therefore, the need there to complete repairs should an engineer, after a pre-construction survey, dictate that that has to be done. That would have to be incorporated and become part of the actual project. Most of you are aware, I suspect, that CEQA requires what is called an alternatives analysis. Now, the alternatives that are analyzed in a CEQA, we looked at several. First of all, we looked at different disposal sites. And in the document, those are listed, and they are specified. We looked at Rock Canyon. We looked at the Marino Ranch area. We looked at Prima and Trinidad Mines area. We looked at the Churro Creek Restoration Area, among others, as potential upland sites that we could dispose of this material. They were eliminated for any number of reasons, again, that are documented in there. Anything from we can only take 10,000 cubic yards. It's a steep grade. You're going to have to widen the road to get the trucks up there. Two, we don't take anything but clean onshore material. Anything with salt in it, we can't take. Those are some of the reasons that these sites were eliminated after a very thorough investigation. After we looked at that, we looked at the power plant. We call it the pit, and it's immediately behind us here, the area that was cut out right behind the power plant, and we looked at that as a possible site. And it was eliminated relatively quickly for the Morrow Shoulder Band snail, and as you probably know, that's a well-documented cultural resource that's actually in Midden where human remains have actually been removed. So that area, as far as because it would have to be excavated and sclerotized to be able to hold the material, any type of disturbance would have become a more significant impact than not using it at all. So that was eliminated. And then the original design actually had armor rock, not a submerged sheet pile wall, on the southern shoreline. And I and Brian and several other people met with Fish and Wildlife Service personnel, Fish and Game, and National Marine Fisheries people to introduce them to the project. And the first thing that came out was no armor on that south shore. It's not going to happen. So we had to go back to the drawing board, and the marine engineers came up with the submerged wall that allows basically the restoration and or the preservation
of much of the shallow water habitat that would have been destroyed, and it also precludes any type of potential for the Moore shoulder band snail along that south area. So again, this was a modification from the original design, and with the two vertical sheet pile walls, that was the project that we assessed in the environmental impact report. So those items were changed. We now have the alternatives that were decided upon, and rather than go through each one of them, I'll just summarize them. Alternative one, no project. Nothing gets done. Planning document, and it allows ultimately for the agency that certifies the EIR to see what their options are. The EIR can be certified, which means it has passed the CEQA doctrine, but they may not approve the project. Those are two totally separate entities. So if one of the alternatives turns out to be feasible, not cost-wise, environmentally, more feasible and superior to the proposed project, then the lead agency and the in this case, the City Council or the Planning Commission, has a right to certify the EIR, but to approve an alternative project. And that's what Mike is referring to, that once the environmental impact report is approved or certified, then an alternative could be identified as the preferred project, supplemental environmental analysis, more detailed than what the alternatives analysis would be done on that approved alternative. Does that make sense? That was rather convoluted, but yes, sir.
One question. So then what you're saying is that the EIR, as is, if that does get approved, and we can get
certified?
Certified.
Yes, sir.
Apologize.
That's all right.
And if we can get actually a waiver, which apparently we are working on, to dredge it offshore, then and that might become an alternative. Is that correct?
Well, let me go through the alternatives okay. that we identified. Three of the alternatives actually have offshore disposal. Okay? So alternative one, again, no project. Things stay they are. Alternative number two is exactly the same project that we have here, vertical sheet pile walls, 150 slips, all of the onshore improvements, but instead of taking the material upland, it would be dredged with a clamshell or a bucket dredge, and would be disposed of at the nearshore disposal site, which is the site that the Army Corps uses for your maintenance dredging of the main channel. Okay, now, that said, clearly the material that's coming out of this marina is not the same as the material that the Army Corps takes out of in your catch basin and your main channel. What we are working on the waiver, so to speak, is not really a waiver. What we are looking for, what the EPA eventually would have to approve, is the disposal of material that is less than 90% sand. So there are several precedent-setting projects. In fact, one is starting, because this is not part of our proposed project, but this is an alternative and is encompassed in several of the other alternatives we're looking at. Okay? Again, further down the line, if that's the preferred alternative, that's where we'll look. Alternative number three. Now, the difference here is instead of having a vertical sheet pile wall on the north shore, we would go with rock riprap, which would mean an augmentation of the existing riprap to the tune of about 6,000 loose cubic yards of armor rock along the north shore that would enhance what is already there. Okay? So there would be no vertical wall. Now, what that does is it eliminates two slips. We do not have, it actually cuts down by about 10,000 cubic yards the amount of dredging, because instead of a vertical slope or vertical wall, we have a slope going down, and the toe of the dredge cut then would be a little further away from the shoreline. But other than that, it really is about the same. We do have nearshore disposal for that alternative also. Oh, let me go back one more. And alternative number four. We call this minimal improvements. Here what we have is we have absolutely nothing along the south shoreline. And if you recollect the picture, and I know you've all seen it, you have a rather large slough area along that south shoreline that will continue. However, By dredging the basin down to the minus 8 feet that it originally was, it will at least allow a bit more free maneuvering during low tides within the marina. The dredging will not include the entrance channel, strictly the marina basin itself. We would do the riprap along the north shore to try and preclude additional erosion from that north shore. Most of the dredge material would end up going to the near shore disposal site. The problem we have here, of course, is that the surficial material, the stuff on the top, has more fines. Sand is more towards the bottom in the deeper area. So we're going to have a higher percentage of fines. So we're still going to probably be stuck with a 50-50, and therefore there's a likelihood that some of that material will still have to be dried and taken up to the Windsor or to some upland disposal site. Okay, and there will be ADA required improvements and the new pump out station, which I failed to mention early on. There's a pump out station proposed that will be instituted with alternative four. Okay, it certainly intuitively it doesn't certainly accomplish as much, and if indeed at the approval process the city council or the planning commission, whoever does that, wants to include that, any project can be approved or can be designed and an assessment can be done on it. But the decision was that we would not include the answer channel.
Could you point out to me at what point the entrance channel that you're referring to starts? Sure. And stops?
Sure. It's a rather general line. Let's see if I can go forward here. Okay. Generally, what we're looking at is we are right about, this is the old city county line.
Right.
So this is the area that we're looking at stopping the dredging.
So you will not dredge beyond that?
That's correct. This marina, this is the area that would be dredged. This would not.
Hmm.
Okay.
That almost gets most of the shallow area.
there are some shallow areas right here, and there are spits and starts of shallow areas throughout that little main channel.
I've hit them all.
Yes, sir.
Thank you.
Okay. Let me go back here. Okay. Now, the key to the whole alternatives analysis is to somehow quantify, albeit a subjective quantification, put some kind of numbers to each of these alternatives so we can compare them to the proposed project. And what I did is I had each one of the technical investigators that did the discussion, the impact assessment for the technical issue, terrestrial biology, noise, air, whatever, to go through and put numerics to each of the alternatives and the project, scale of 1 to 5. And what we ended up doing is we had 12 issues that were identified. It was a strict mathematical process whereby we looked at the numerics that were created, divided it by 12, and ended up with a number. The higher the number, the better the more environmentally superior the project. Okay, so we end up with a ranking, and we'll just go through that. The proposed project, you can see, is 2.2, and it works its way up. No project, and the reasoning on all. Okay, so what this says is that alternative number four would have the fewest environmental effects of the five projects that we looked at. Now, in the process of approving a project, the city council, planning commission, whoever, even with this documentation, can say, we certify the EIR and we approve alternative three. That can be done as long as they put in a statement of overriding considerations, which is a document that specifies why we, the lead agency, are approving something other than an environmentally superior project. And it is done, I won't say routinely, but it's not unusual for that to happen. And I'm not dictating that. All I'm saying is this is what the CEQA document indicates is the best, or the environmentally superior project, ultimately, the approval and certification will be up to your city. Okay? So that, in a nutshell, is the process. And now, questions and comments, but here we are. So I thank you very much, and we're more than happy to answer any other questions you might have.
Thank you. We'll start, if you will, down here with Bill. Do you have questions? Lynn?
We've got to figure out how to say it.
Okay. You want me to? Gene.
Yes. I had several issues with EIR. I felt that their statement that trucking was a not potential or significant problem is in error. If you consider a 20-yard truck, a truck and trailer, it's going to call 18 yards. That's 8,333 trips one way. That means the truck's got to come back. That's 16,666 trips. Over 6 months, that's 120 working days. That's 138 trips per day. At 8 hours, that comes to one truck every 3.5 minutes. And during, as you propose, between 9 and 4, that becomes 6 hours. You have one trip, one every 2.5 minutes. I drive that road every day. It takes more than 2.5 minutes to drive, or if they go down Main Street, it's going to be a truckload of mud going down that street. I feel that that's a erroneous conclusion on that EIR statement. You'll have to rebuild the road. There's just no way around that. I also found problems with the traffic at the South Bay Boulevard and the Lower Park Road connection that I did not see addressed. That's a potentially hazard corner to turn, and if you're going to turn left, it becomes even worse. Especially during the daytime traffic. I just find some problems there.
Okay.
I wanted to mention, I appreciate the CD. Unfortunately, I was unable to open up the picture, the description of the project. All I saw was an aerial, but just a few bands came through. But I appreciate it. I read through the whole thing.
Okay. I'm sorry, Mr. Doherty. The figures, you were unable to see the figures on the CD?
Yeah, where you saw your description of the proposed project, that I never saw that icon. And I don't know why.
I think that's figure 2.1 or 2.3, I believe. I'll have to take a look.
Okay.
I'd be interested to know if that's universal or whether it's just bad on that one CD.
I have no idea.
I apologize for that. All right.
No. I read through it, everything. I wanted to be able to look at it.
Okay.
And in somewhere in that document, it mentioned that there would be no significant impact to a hotel. And I went back this afternoon, and I couldn't figure out where that was at. But you could probably just run search and find hotel and eliminate that. Because if there was ever a hotel proposed somewhere, they could say, hey, look, we're not going to have a problem here. So.
Yeah, the only thing I could think of would be the Golden Tee.
Yeah, you and I are on the same page when we say Golden Tee.
Yeah, and that was one time. And I think one of the early we did a noise survey there, and that was one of our noise sites. It may well have been, but I will certainly search that. Yes, sir.
And then you did mention that you're going to remove the, I believe 120 eucalyptus trees. Is that
no,
correct?
Sir? 14.
14. Okay.
Correct. 14.
Okay. And then you mentioned a vibrating hammer. I was in the pile drivers union for a number of years. I've used a vibrating hammer. I've used a drop hammer, the diesel hammers. What a vibrating hammer is going to do, is it going to kill or destroy? It needs to be reviewed by the state Marine Life Protection Act people, regulators.
Fish and Game is the regulatory authority on that, and
okay.
they will be routinely copied with an EIR through the state clearinghouse process.
Okay, so, I didn't know whether that was a separate sub issue or something or other. and then I saw no mention of one of the alternatives that's been presented here in the last two or three meetings of a small dredge working I don't know, a little at a time, doing just, you know, small amount of dredging, and then taking the dredge spoils and putting them up in bags where they're dewatered. And I didn't see any of that presented at all. And then the cost. I don't know what the cost is proposing at this point, but I would think that that should be some part of the EIR. I know it's not environmental, but it's like this thing is going to cost $1 billion, you know, and like this is for 150 slips. Is there some benefit here? I don't know. It just seems like that's an awful lot of money to do it, but that's not your job, I understand. But and then in looking at your layout, I know that we're not supposed to be discussing the plan itself, but I just see no turning basin, which has been presented in front of us several times, for the boats. I looked at some of the scale here, and I think that's more like a parking lot, not necessarily a marina. Those are my comments.
Well, I appreciate those, sir. And again, that's why it's so important that we do have a transcript, and each one of those will be responded to in writing in the final AIR, and hopefully it will be made available to you, and hopefully the responses will answer those questions.
Thank you.
Thank you, sir.
Lynn, are you ready?
I don't know if I'm being naive. Perhaps I am naive. But Mr. Ricano said something that the Coastal Commission will never, ever permit all of this dredging of this or the near-site disposal. And is it possible that if that's such an absolute, then we're really wasting a lot of time and money on something that isn't even a possibility?
I can't answer that. Our assessment, of course, is to look at the environmental impacts. The permitting process will certainly answer that. We have had discussions with the Coastal Commission and as a recreational resource. The engineers designed something that they feel will allow this to function with minimal maintenance dredging. And during the permitting process, assuming that the EIR is certified and a project is approved and the city wants to go for permitting, that will be identified during the process. What we look at is what are the impacts of what is proposed. We also have a land use policy. There's a land use section in there that goes through and takes a look at consistency of the various policies from the city, state, and federal. And and again, each one of those policies are looked at. The Coastal Commission, certainly this is an appealable project, and during the permitting process and ultimately hopefully the issuance of a CDP, the Coastal Commission will certainly have an opportunity to convey their feeling on the design and may well recommend some alternative and or permit only with conditions that specify some changes.
But then you do think, with your experience with the Coastal Commission, that something is doable here that they would approve?
I do. Yes, ma'am. Yes, ma'am. If it was a new marina, if we were looking to do what was done in 1949, I suspect that it would never fly because the wetlands were not only destroyed within the marina, but then the little peninsula to the south was created by the dredge spoils. That nowadays would not be allowed. But we have an existing facility that is of use and is of value and is fairly unique between Point Conception and Monterey in that it is the largest marina available for private boats. So I think the Coastal Commission will look upon it favorably on those particular points.
Thank you.
Mm-hmm. Bill? Nope. Anything further? I have just a global comments, I guess they're best referred to as, and appreciative of Gene's comments, too. My experience with this sort of thing is new, and it just seems that the project to date has been overwhelmingly complex. And from that standpoint, it seems, as Lynn mentioned, potentially with a project of that size and magnitude, it would drive most of them out of there because of the per foot cost of keeping a boat back there. Gene mentioned too the likelihood of that State Park Road holding up. It's hardly holding up now under regular traffic, and I think I would agree with him that if you sent too many trucks over it, it would have to be rebuilt. And that part of it worries me. I think of other projects like Union Oil and Avila, what they had to do to that town to mitigate the problem they had there. And that part of it would worry me. I'm also maybe not clear, but on the alternatives, the alternative number four, which seems the most reachable at this point from my reading of the draft of the EIR, would seem to be of little value if that entrance isn't dredged. I mean, you get a boat in there, you can't get it out anyway, so what good does it do to have it not sitting on the bottom while it's in there? And I do know, and you know, and as you mentioned, where the shallow spots are. And you don't go in and out of there without hitting at least one of them each time unless it's at absolutely high tide. And alternative, maybe I can ask this as a question, because alternative number four is that, and the stipulations involved in it, is that changeable, modifiable as the process goes on?
The alternative that was analyzed was defined specifically by the city as lead agency, the Harbor Department. I will reiterate that should the EIR be certified and a project approved, that agency, City Council, could indeed modify the approved project. They can say, we approve alternative four with the stipend or with the amendment that the dredging include the entrance channel. And they can be as specific or as general as they want. What would then happen, Chairman Phillips, is that should the city decide to go further, that a supplemental EIR focusing now on alternative four as the proposed project would be defined very specifically along these lines here. Exactly what would
that part of the entrance channel was looked at in terms of and included in the dredging process. Is that true?
No, that's not true.
So it's never been.
When I first came on board on this, which was a little over about two and a half years ago, and we were still looking at a riprap on the South Shore and the dredging only going basically to that city-county line. And in fact, in consultation, we identified it doesn't do much good, exactly what you just said. Why have a basin there that you can't get in and out of? And so that was expanded at about the same time that we realized that the rock riprap on the south side was not going to fly because of the habitat and sensitive resource concerns.
Is it, in your view, a particular problem because it isn't in the city and it is in either state or wildlife territory out there?
I'll defer to Mike, but my understanding is that there is an MOA now between the city and county that has allowed that. But Mike, that's
what is an MOA, by the way?
Memorandum of Agreement.
Oh, okay.
Correct, Chairman. That area is outside of the city limits, and it kind of became a county permitting and joint effort, if you will. And so we had worked with their county staff to incorporate any of their concerns and all of their policy language that they have adopted part of our process so that we satisfied any of concerns that they may have had. And they agreed to that process. And so they wouldn't seek any permits from a project via the city if we pursued that. And so that took a while to get to that effort. In addition to that, once we get out of the limited county, it becomes State Lands Commission. So we had another hurdle. So there was a number of hurdles as to why we didn't include it initially. I think we worked through most of those as we got later into this process that led us to believe that we should make that part of our proposed project. And that's how it got there.
Thank you. Yes, Bill.
Again, to re-clarify, the proposed project is going to dredge the channel, correct?
Yes, sir.
So am I to assume then that if this ERA gets certified, we are certifying the proposed project? So therefore, if we decide to go with alternative four or whatever, then the dredging of the channel has already been certified. So why would we need a supplement ERA? I'm just kind of curious.
Okay. If it is not the proposed project, because the level of environmental analysis for the proposed project is much, much more detailed than the alternatives, then the supplemental would go back and detail the impacts, tiering on to the impact assessment that was already done for the approved project. Does that make sense, sir? Okay.
I have just one more question. In the page which it talks about the ranking numbers, it indicates that no project is 3.3. That's not a perfect score. So if we did nothing, there will be environmental impacts associated with doing nothing, right?
That is correct. And those center around water quality, hydrology, risk, and land use and recreation, because of existing conditions that are so poor in those, they will continue to deteriorate.
So in the long run, if we did nothing back there and the marina continued to silt in so that boats would have to be moved out, ultimately it's going to have a negative impact anyway.
Well, ultimately, I mean, it will cease to function as a marina.
Yeah. And but that won't necessarily adversely affect the environment.
I'm a marine biologist by technical background, and I've been doing this for 33 years. And in the marine biological aspect, I'd be tickled to death because it creates more eelgrass habitat, et cetera, et cetera. Eventually, it will become an upland area or a wetland area, which Mr. Dugas is very pleased with. But in the interim, by not dredging, eventually it will become too shallow, the boats will leave, and that will become a shallow water habitat that will be, there will be no disturbance. Okay, so okay. That's why the no project is quite environmentally sensible to me, mm-hmm. as a marine biologist, but it doesn't equate to being as sensible for other technical issues.
For other reasons, sure. Bill?
One last question. In your knowledge here, if we did nothing, when would the marina tend to cease to exist as a marina?
It's a very good question. And we actually had a sedimentation analysis study, and it actually is appended to the environmental document. And I can't recollect, but I believe with nothing done, I think within 25...
Speaking of the difficulties people were having with the CD, I had a couple of people call me, one in particular, and I tried to, on my computer, talk them through it to find the executive summary. I understand that this report in its entirety is available in different places, but, and maybe this is a question for the staff here, it might be helpful to the average public anyway to have the executive summary pulled out of that and
out of the document, the volume one,
and available for those that want to take a quick look at what's being proposed and not go through the several hundred pages of it. That'd be a suggestion. Anyway, any further questions of Ray? Thank you very much.
Thank you, sir. Thank you.
Our next item on the agenda is consideration of forming an ad hoc committee to review the live aboard ordinance. What I think ought to be our goal and purpose tonight anyway, rather than to form a committee, is to decide on what we want as a committee. And then to put off until at least the next meeting anything formalizing that ad hoc committee. So the background to this recognizes that the city of Morro Bay has a liveaboard ordinance. The ordinance was passed in 1993, and it is thought to be timely, for instance, to review that and to see if, at least by comparison with other cities who have liveaboard ordinances, if there's something we might do to recommend to the city council that there be changes in the Morro Bay liveaboard ordinance. So, with that in mind, we maybe want to discuss a subcommittee or an ad hoc committee. Who will be on the committee? What its composition be like? Maybe how many people?
We were supposed to do some work, you know, again, in trying to get some people together and maybe talk to them a little bit, too. I mean, I don't know where all that is. So, you know, I don't know where Eric is on his progress right now.
Maybe in order to get this on track here, maybe we should just, first of all, it seems to me it would be a good idea for the Harbor Advisory Board to have an ad hoc committee made up of at least one or two members of the Harbor Advisory Board, and then other members that may have some or people that might have some interest in liveaboards. So I know Lynn has said in the past that you would be interested in being on that committee or having something to do with the liveaboards. So I'll ask you again if you're still interested. Bill has indicated an interest in...
No.
No. And there's no over here.
And the last one.
And I've, I too would... not that I'm not interested in it, but I'm still involved with the Green Wave Energy thing and the newspaper racks and that sort of stuff. So,
Well, that leaves the two of you. So I think that's fine, but I think we should also get, you know, maybe like Eric on the committee and a couple people, other little boards, and form and compile something.
Okay. So we would have you and Lynn and the Harbor Department. Do you think it would be wise to have anyone else other than yourself, for instance, who is not a liveaboard, to be on the ad hoc committee?
I have been actually approached by a couple people, regarding a liveaboard situation, and to bring it up. That's one of the reasons why I've been kind of bringing it up every so often, and they have stated that it's a major problem. Now, whether or not it is or not, I really can't judge it. I'm not down at the waterfront all the time. Yeah. So maybe we put a little notice and ask for any interest from the general public to see if there is any interest.
Those people you mentioned, are they business people on the Embarcadero?
Well, one is actually Gene's neighbor.
I'm not asking that
okay,
you identify
and,
him
and,
now. But,
and
yeah.
Another one actually owns a...
Two things. One, let it be known to the liveaboards out there that this is to be discussed, mm-hmm. and to see if any of them wish to participate. And two, I think we need to know the status of liveaboard compliance with the current ordinance, and have some data on that. We need a place to start with questions as to what kinds of questions, what kinds of problems we're looking for.
Okay.
If I might interject, sure. I know that we have had a couple of people come into the office and express an interest in potentially being involved in the process of being on the board, liveaboards. And we've tried to get the word out through our newsletter, and of course it's also in our documents that are available for people to review. We could, I mean, part of the reason we suggested to just look at this and think right now about who you might want to be on this is that it might take a little time to set up exactly the committee you want, and it might be worth taking a little time so that you have a good group of people who are willing to commit the time that it will take to go through this, because the last time it took, I think, a couple of years by the time we really got through all the issues and had enough public meetings and got to something that we could even recommend to City Council. So it is something that will take a substantive amount of time. And staff is usually involved, whether it would be myself, Rick, or Eric, or a combination, who would be at those meetings. They would be publicly noticed meetings, so there would be opportunity for the public to have a say as well. So I think at this point, if the board could, you know, if you have an idea in mind of how many other people, for example, now we already have the two Harbor Advisory Board people, and if, say, example, Bill knows maybe one or two people who might want to be on the board, we had at least one person come in and express interest. Mm-hmm. We might want to open it up and let people come in and put their names up and then decide right now how many maximum, and then we can, at the next meeting, have a nominating committee or make that final decision.
Okay.
And I think also it will be important at that point to determine, do you want to meet once a month, every other month, and that kind of thing.
Okay. And I take it, one question would be, do you have a way of contacting all who are officially live aboards in the harbor now?
Yes. Everybody gets to be too big, gets unwieldy.
I would agree with you. Okay, so we can we will think of then an ad hoc committee of five people, two of which are harbor board people. We will leave the staff as a reference for further information and data, and seek then three other participants. And hopefully allowing as wide a representation as would be necessary in that regard. I don't think we need to vote on any of that stuff, do we? Just kind of set it into the minutes?
You could just say by consensus you would like us to maybe put out a notice to see if anyone else is interested in serving on a potential committee.
And so moved.
Yeah.
And I would suggest if you have specific people in mind, then let us know.
Okay.
And we can make sure, because if they're not a live aboard, we can make sure they get a notice as well.
Since this ad hoc committee would ultimately report back to the Harbor Advisory Board and would result in some kind of a suggestion, recommendation to the City Council, I would think that the chairman of it should be on the Harbor Advisory Board, which means that either one of you two would need to sit in that position. So maybe between now and our next meeting, you can decide which one. Is that fair? Sounds good to me. Okay. And I would find it difficult to decide at this point how often they should meet. They might find it necessary to meet more frequently in the beginning and less frequently in the end, or I don't know. What do you think, Sue?
I've seen it work both ways. When we did the Boating Access Facility Committee, they met a little more frequently at the beginning, and then it was less frequently. You can have your first meeting and discuss that among the members and make a set decision. Yes, we're going to meet once a month, or you can say, I think we have so much material to look at.
What we can suggest then is we'll move to the next step, which is the formulation of who is going to be on the ad hoc committee, and then ask them to decide amongst themselves the frequency with which they'll meet, at least
initially.
You can
set that as a topic for your first meeting.
Sure,
you
sure.
Have that as number one.
Because obviously schedules are going to vary and all of that.
Ad hoc committee.
Gene?
If I remember right, we met twice a month for a long time. But we wanted to keep the energy flowing, so in a sense.
Okay, well, let's leave that open now for a decision, but that's something that will have to be decided once the committee is together. Uh, And I don't know that we need to do anything more with that at this point, other than keep it in mind for future agendas, so that we can get a report from the committee once it's established. Huh?
So to be clear, it sounded to me like consensus is you would like the harbor staff to notify the liveaboards, the permitted liveaboards, that this committee is going to be forming, and ask if anyone would like to volunteer to be on it, and let them know we have three open spaces, and that they should, we should probably give them a time period of which to respond. If you want this back before your next meeting, or if you're willing to wait till two meetings from now, that's up to you. We should put some kind of a time frame so people know when to get back to us.
From your experience, would a month of the time between now and October be sufficient time to get the notice out?
Well, I'm thinking by the time we get the notice out and people get it, the meeting is pretty early in October. I think it's the 2nd.
It is.
So I don't know that we'd have quite enough time to get everybody answering.
Okay, well.
So I think a more realistic goal would be to have that for November.
Well, let's, with concurrence, the rest of the board here will set November as a goal for receiving all of the applicants, people of interest.
And then at our November meeting, you could decide specifically on the board and set the very first meeting, which could be, you know, within weeks of that meeting.
Sure.
It doesn't have to be a month out, depending upon what the first few items.
We would just look at their, talk to them, and
and if you'd like, we could ask people, if you're interested, provide us with a letter of interest, why you want to be on it, and then at least you have something to go
on. That would give us something to go by, to yeah, make a decision rather than.
Sure, I think that's a good idea. That gives you something more objective to evaluate. Yeah. Yeah, because we want to, as we've talked about already, we want to look at the breadth of
right,
people who are interested, as well as the degree of interest that they have. So mm-hmm, maybe a letter or a statement of some sort, written statement would be good, and we can, as a board, we can evaluate those and.
And could you put just as a general, I mean, there are people that I will talk to, but a little notice in the I don't know, the Sun Bulletin. Call them up and see if anyone is interested in to send in a letter, I mean, from the general public. And we'll see, will we get any responses? And I think that's a good idea.
Or the Bay News.
Yeah, the Bay News. That's
the Bay News
is probably a more, yeah.
Really, yeah. Covers waterfront stuff.
Yeah.
I can certainly let them know that that's what we're doing.
And they'll put a little article in there for you. I mean, I'm not talking about a huge
yeah,
article.
Yeah.
I'm just talking about, mm-hmm, you know.
That too sounds like a good idea. Any other suggestions? Sue, any other?
No, just be aware what you're volunteering for will probably be a pretty long process. It won't be quite as long as the first time because we have a document to go by.
Sure.
That overall has worked fairly well, despite there are issues, but if you talk to any harbor, no matter what the ordinance is, it's always a difficult aspect to enforce. So there will be issues regardless, but at least we're starting with a document that we can work from, so it won't be quite as arduous a process as it was the first time around.
Do you know if we've been given the ordinance before, or as it exists now? Do we have copies of it?
I think we did at one of our initial briefings, but
okay,
we can do that at the November meeting as well, since we'll have a lot of new people at that meeting. We
sure,
can include that again.
In your packet for October?
For October or for November?
For October, so that we can look at it.
Okay.
June. It was in our June 5th meeting.
Oh, okay. Well, I probably have it then. So,
so okay. I'll scratch that.
Scratch that. Yeah, okay. Scratch that. I guess if Bill finds he doesn't have it, he'll come down and get one from you.
We have plenty of them.
Okay. So. Okay. If there's no other questions there, we'll move on to informational items, the Harbor Department status report. in the absence of Rick. Are you going to do that, Sue?
Sure.
Okay. Thank you.
Since we already kind of went over the State Marina project, I won't discuss that.
Okay.
Something that will be coming up at our October meeting that I think will be of interest to a lot of people is potential ballot amendment for Measure D. Measure D concerns the area north of Beach Street and the planning and zoning in that area. There's been a lot of discussion about a need to potentially amend that to allow for a certain level of flexibility while still maintaining that the main goal is to keep marine-oriented businesses there. Because of the lack of fishing, because of the increasing regulations, it's been more and more difficult to do that. And the thought is to try to work some kind of wording that would still preserve the existing marine-related dependent type of businesses, but allow for a little bit more flexibility in those businesses to be more viable. Whether that will be possible, we're not sure. Council has looked at this a couple times, and they would like our board to look at it and have a meeting where public can come and make comments.
So October will be public comment?
Yes.
Microphone.
And that's part of the reason we put it in the newsletter early, was we wanted to get the word out, so hopefully people will be aware. Something that I do in our newsletter every year is a little thing on storm preparation. And I always feel like I'm somewhat beating a dead horse, but we all know that every winter we get gnarly winds. Even if we don't get a lot of rain, we will have several big, big windy events. And we really request that boat owners take the opportunity now, before the weather gets bad, to beef up their moorings, their slips, however they're tied up. There's different things you can do to kind of make your boat a little safer. And the other thing we would strongly urge is, when you hear that forecast, and usually these events, we do get a pretty good window of warning. If you hear that type of a forecast, please to try and be aware of these things and be proactive.
Sue, I want to thank you for that. I want to follow up on that a little bit. If a boat owner could at least have an additional pennant line, or you have it in your article there, but I mean an extra line when you get on board to try to tie that boat down because the other one is chased through, instead of trying to figure out, well, I just used the last line over here, and what am I going to do to put on this line here? If the boat owner have an extra line there, and it needs to be a good 3/4-inch line, to tie things down for a little while. Thanks.
No, we appreciate that. And we really would request that people try to come down and check on their boat and everything that they can do ahead of time when these conditions are predicted. It helps everybody and it helps yourself. So it's a good thing to do. Salmon disaster funds. Everybody knows salmon was a disaster this year. There is some funding available. At the time that we did the newsletter, the criteria as to how they were going to disperse those funds was not set. We don't know whether it has been yet, but you can check online at the Pacific State Marine Fisheries Commission website, www.psmfc.org. They will need your fish and game and wildlife contact and permit information. So just if you've been affected by that, please check online. There is some funding available. There's going to be a Meet the Fleet event on Friday, October 3rd from 6 to 9 right here in the Vets Hall. And that's being put on in conjunction with some funding from the liaison, the cable committee, and the Central Coast Women for Fisheries. So if you're interested in that, you can RSVP by October 1st to Lori French at Crabber, C-R-A-B-B-E-R, at wildblue.net. Should be kind of a fun event. You get to meet some of our local fishermen, sample some of the things they get locally, locally sustainably caught fish, probably the best you can get. 2008 Harbor Festival is right around the corner. Just a reminder to everybody who frequents our area of the waterfront, starting as early as Tuesday, September 30th, they will be starting to set up down there. So if you usually park down there, think about parking elsewhere. Same with people who are parking long-term in the area near the intake. That's around the time where you're going to be expected to move your... would impact potentially the Harbor Fund. They're looking into relooking at the overhead cost allocation, which is charging the Harbor Fund and other funds like wastewater treatment and sewer plant for services that the general fund does for us. So that's something that could be done. At the August workshop that City Council had relating to that management partners report and some of their presentations, one thing they wanted specifically to Harbor to look at was to provide the council with information on maintenance services that we do, and they're looking at potentially having one centralized maintenance facility that takes care of all city facilities. And so we need to discuss that. And I think that for the most part, major maintenance, we already do contract out because it's very specialized and requires special equipment and tools. And so most of the major things we do already contract out. One of the other things the council is interested in was a comparison of fees in other harbors. And they feel that we really should relook at the fee structure. Not necessarily at this time anything to do with the commercial boat slips, but with all our recreational related fees and including mooring fees. So they do want us to look at that. And the other area they talked about would be a boat launch parking fee and, again, the potential increase in mooring fees. So that's something that we will be providing council with information on within the next 6 to 12 months. And we'll, of course, report to the board anything we do with that. And then the liveaboards ordinance review, we've kind of gone through that. And I'll just briefly go through some of the upcoming events. We've got on September 20th is the Avocado Margarita Festival, the second one. It's supposed to be just as good as the first one was, if not better. Coastal Cleanup Day, the 24th annual one, is September 20th. If you're interested on that, you can find information on EcoSlo's website. And Tall Ship Replica of the Nino will be in Morro Bay November 5th through the 16th. They're going to be docked at Marina Square. If you're interested in finding out about tours on that boat, just contact Chamber of Commerce. And again, just a real advance notice, Light of Boat Parade is set for December 6th. So those are some of the upcoming events. Any questions, comments? Oh, one other thing I almost forgot, just as item of news. The Chablis, which is one of the tour boats, had an interesting exercise. So it is in the launch ramp. It's taking up quite a bit of space. Boats can still get in and out right now. It's just a little tighter down there. But it's quite something to see. I thought that's something people should be aware of.
Thank you very much. Any additional comments, Bill? Lynn? Gee. No additional comments. Future agenda items. We know that October 4th will be Measure D. Anything else? Well, Measure D may take up most of the evening anyway, so we'll leave it at that. Maybe just staff could report if they've got any, if they've received any information on interest in the liveaboard ad hoc committee. Just let us know if there's anything happened by that point in time. Lynn?
Yeah. In oral communications of our last meeting, we talked about Dan Murphy and his little proposal. And at that time, we said, or he said that he would like to address questions, having the questions written. Well, we haven't really done anything about that. And I'm wondering if maybe we should try, if we are interested in actually developing a list of questions relating to that form of dredging instead of the big project that we just got a big report on.
Okay, I think that's good. Let me just ask members of the board here to either provide to the staff there or bring to the meeting next time any written questions they might have based upon his proposal. I know there were several questions that I had, and I've written them down. I've got them at home.
Right.
But we might as well try to compile those and turn them back to him so that he can do what he said he would do, which is to try to find answers.
Would you want to put that in the mail to him, or would you want to agendize it for another meeting discussion? I mean, that the one that he provided at the last meeting was also forwarded to Padre to include in comments on the EIR. So they will also be addressing his specific questions as they relate to the draft EIR.
I think what he was offering to do was to answer questions that
you may have
that we had of the earlier to bring the questions that we would need to bring.
But if we're going to agendize it, and the written comments should be part of the packet, I would think.
Jim?
Yes.
Maybe we could just have one of us, we could email our individual questions to one of our board members, and then just we can print those out and collate them somehow.
Okay, well, why don't you in the near future then email
them
to me?
Send them. Okay.
Email them to me, and I'll put them together and give them to staff so they can be included.
So we will agendize that.
No, that's all right. I'll do it.
Okay.
Yeah. Okay.
I'll do that. Okay. So I'm asking the board members to formulate their questions and email them to me, I'll give it to you afterwards. I'm not asking that everybody in the community email me, so. and then I'll forward those questions onto staff so they can be included in the report. Okay. Any others? Okay. Do I have a motion to adjourn?
Motion to adjourn.
It's moved by Bill and seconded by?
Sure.
Lynn. To adjourn. All those in favor?
Aye.
We are adjourned. Thank you very much.